Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Last week, the Financial Times reported that Google researchers may have demonstrated quantum supremacy in computing, calculating in minutes what would take the fastest classical computer thousands of years to do. Quantum computing might become just another in a large number of practical applications for a theory that Albert Einstein described as spooky and that Richard Feynman said nobody really understands. Does quantum mechanics deserve such a reputation? Well, Caltech physicist Sean Carroll argues that it doesn't. And he seeks to demystify one of the most successful theories in the history of physics in his latest book, Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. It's published by Dutton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sean Carroll to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is a, let's get really basic, what is a quantum computer?
Well, a quantum computer is a computer that makes intimate use of the rules of quantum mechanics, by which we mean, you know, if you have a bit on a classical computer, it's either 0 or 1. On a quantum computer, if you think of Schrödinger's cat or the wave of an electron, all these sort of quantum ideas that you may have vaguely heard of, in a quantum computer, a bit can be in any superposition of 0 and 1. So it can be almost all 0, but a little bit 1, or half 0, half 1, anywhere in between.
So
and
what kinds of
qubits?
Okay, go ahead. Qubits. I was going to ask
qubits
you about them.
Are what they call them, and then they can get entangled with each other, and there's basically just a lot more that can be going on at any one time in a quantum computer than in a classical computer.
So what kinds of problems would be difficult for classical computers but manageable or even easy for a quantum computer?
Well, that's a big question. We actually are a little bit unclear about that. There's been this amusing race where people would say, look, I've invented a quantum algorithm that is faster at this problem than any classical algorithm, but then someone else would go invent a better classical algorithm and beat it. The example everyone has in mind is factoring large numbers. You know, if you take a huge number, a 20-digit number, and say, break it up into the numbers you have to multiply by each other to make that, this is the central idea of all of modern cryptography. This is why we can send messages that are difficult to decode or break the code. But quantum computers might be able to do that really quickly.
What can you tell us about the work done at Google? Have you seen the paper that was briefly posted on a NASA website?
I have not seen it. It was sort of, you know, not supposed to be posted, et cetera. But it's an important stepping stone. It's a small stepping stone, but an important one. They're asking this question, is it possible in principle to come up with a problem where we know quantum computers can be much faster than classical computers? And they're saying yes. Now, they're saying they've done it. This problem is not that interesting all by itself. They basically worked as hard as they could to come up with a problem that would be tailor-made for a quantum computer to solve, and that's what they did.
Google's been competing with IBM and Intel, among others. Should we be concerned that private for-profit businesses might try to patent basic physics?
I don't think you can patent basic physics, but that's a very good legal question. You know, there's every time that there's scientific advances, private businesses move in and want to take advantage of them and make money, and that's often to the benefit of everybody. But it can be bad when they try to claim the knowledge for themselves. You know, they patent genes and viruses and so forth these days. So we'll have to see about that. I think that there's a lot of good basic physics being done in universities, not just at Google and IBM and Microsoft. So there's a lot of knowledge out there that is free for sharing with everybody.
Kip Thorne, your colleague at Caltech, helped to develop the movie Interstellar, in which relativity and gravitational theory played big roles. Does quantum theory have the same kind of fascination in the popular imagination that relativity has?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things I said in my book, I went to Amazon.com and I typed in the word quantum into the search bar to look for books with the word quantum in the title, and you find not just quantum mechanics and quantum physics, but quantum yoga and quantum touch and quantum healing. There's plenty of movies about alternate timelines and what can happen in parallel universes and so forth. I think that quantum mechanics is perhaps the most misused physical theory in all of popular culure.
And you're right that semiconductors, transistors, microchips, lasers, and computer memory all rely on quantum mechanics to function. So does quantum mechanics have more bearing on our daily lives than relativity does?
Yeah, I would say there's no question. The fact that your chair is solid relies on quantum mechanics. You know, you don't need to go fancy to see quantum mechanics in action. Without quantum mechanics, all of matter would be dramatically unstable. So everything about our everyday life is intimately making use of quantum mechanics. Of course, that didn't really become clear until the early 20th century, and we're still learning how to really take advantage of the quantumness of the everyday world.
That would suggest that the engineers and scientists developing various technologies might be doing it with a little knowledge of the underlying theory.
Quantum mechanics is definitely in an interesting position where, you know, I use the analogy, it's kind of like you and I using our smartphones, right? We can use them, fine. We can send text messages, we can check our email or whatever, but we might not know what's going on at the level of the integrated circuit inside. And that's how physicists think about quantum mechanics. We can use it really, really well. A race car driver doesn't necessarily need to know how to build a race car. But we would like to know more than that. We would really like to understand the inner working. That's what Richard Feynman was referring to when he says, I think I can safely say nobody understands quantum mechanics. He says, sure, I can use it, I can make predictions, but if I really ask what's going on, as a field, physicists don't quite have the answer to that.
I blame everything that goes on in my phone on algorithms, but that's a whole other story. just in case some of our listeners don't have PhDs in theoretical physics, can you give us the elevator introduction to quantum theory, or is that even possible?
No, I think it's very possible. You know, the motto you have to keep in mind for quantum mechanics is that the world that we see when we look at it is different than how we describe the world when we're not looking at it. That's a crazy, wild feature of quantum mechanics. It's enshrined in all the textbooks. It's what Einstein didn't like about it. We're still struggling to come to terms with it. We describe, you know, an elementary particle like an electron as a wave when we're not looking at it. But when we measure it, when we observe it, it looks like a particle to us. And that just causes us all sorts of difficulties. And physicists and philosophers are still trying to understand what exactly that means.
And hasn't there been a problem in reconciling relativity and quantum mechanics? Since they have both accepted physics, why can't they be reconciled?
Well, there's two different kinds of relativity. There's special relativity, which is just basically, you know, you can't travel faster than the speed of light. And there's general relativity, which says space-time is curved and that curvature is gravity. So general relativity is all about gravity. Special relativity is 100% compatible with quantum mechanics. There's no problem. It's always been compatible. There's never been a worry. General relativity, which has gravity in it, that's something more difficult. We've never quite yet been able to come up with a quantum mechanical theory that gives us gravity as we know it in our everyday lives.
Even people who haven't studied science may still have heard about things like the uncertainty principle. Does that lead to popular misconceptions about quantum theory?
Yeah, I think that the misconceptions come from two places. One is that quantum mechanics is hard. It's counterintuitive. It's not what we're used to, and therefore it's easy to misunderstand and misinterpret. And the other is that, as I said, physicists don't agree about what quantum mechanics says. So if physicists can't agree on it, then when they're trying to explain things to people, people are going to get confused very naturally. A simple question like, is an atom mostly empty space? You'll hear a lot of physicists explain with great awe and reverence that, you know, an atom is actually mostly empty. And I think that that's completely wrong. I think that's just a bad version of quantum mechanics that they're thinking about. So I don't blame people on the street who get mixed up about quantum mechanics because physicists can't agree on what it says.
You're right that what makes quantum mechanics unequivocally distinct from its classical predecessor centers on what's called the measurement problem. What's the measurement problem?
Well, it's exactly this fact that quantum mechanics is the only theory in the history of physics where we seem to need different rules for how systems behave when we observe them, when we measure them, when we look at them. And the rules that we're taught are that when you're not looking, a quantum system is kind of wavy and spread out, but then you look at it and it snaps into some particular configuration. You see an electron located at a particular place. And so that's what we teach our students. But then if the student says, well, when does a measurement happen? What counts as measuring? Does it have to be human? Could it be an atom? Could it be a videotape recorder? and the conventional story says, we don't know. That's the measurement problem. Like, if you have this idea that a measurement is a fundamental part of your theory, you should at least be able to tell me what a measurement actually is.
Does classical physics remain a reasonably good description of the world at large scales and at slow speeds? Is the problem with quantum that it's harder to actually imagine?
Yeah, you know, classical physics is still enormously useful. All of us, even the most highly trained quantum physicists, still have an intuition that is pretty classical. You know, we think of tables and chairs as pretty solid objects, even if we know that they're really waves. You don't need quantum mechanics to plot a trajectory from the Earth to Mars, for example. It's all classical physics all the way down. And so that's telling us something about the structure of the real world. One of the things we would like to understand about quantum mechanics is why classical mechanics is such a good approximation to it. It's not at all obvious, and I think that it's sort of an underappreciated problem because physicists don't really worry about the foundations of quantum mechanics itself enough.
Isn't quantum physics essentially probabilistic or statistical? But weren't probabilistic or statistical frameworks already critical to some fields of physics before the quantum theory was even developed?
Well, there you go. I mean, this is part of the problem. This is part of the thing we don't understand. Is quantum mechanics intrinsically random, or is it just apparently random? And again, we don't know the answer. So you're right, there is plenty of use of concepts in probability and statistics long before quantum mechanics came along. There was statistical mechanics, in fact, where you would explain the features of the air in the room around you as a huge number of atoms and molecules. You don't know where every atom and molecule is, but you know the statistical properties of the distribution. And that's fine, but you know that really there is some individual particular location for all the atoms. And quantum mechanics is saying something immeasurably more profound. It's not that you don't know where the atoms are, it's that there is no such thing as where they are before you measure them. And that's what we're trying to grapple with.
You describe quantum mechanics as one of the most successful theories in science, but how can a theory be successful but still be the subject of so many interpretations or debates?
Yeah, because we can use it. It's exactly like the smartphone. You know, we can take quantum mechanics and we can ask questions that are well-defined, like if I collide these two particles together, what are they going to turn into, right? This is what we do at particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. When we discovered the Higgs boson, quantum mechanics was all over the calculations that went into that particular discovery. We smashed particles together. We used quantum mechanics to predict what they would turn into and what fraction of the time they would make Higgs bosons. But then again, if you ask, okay, what exactly is happening when we made that observation, nobody knows. So it's a very weird, unusual situation where...
Or the significance of what's happening? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, the significance of what's happening, you know, you can debate that, but if we don't even know what's happening, it's hard to debate the significance of it, right? Mm-hmm. We don't even know the language to use or the way to describe the reality of it. All we can do is make these predictions for experimental outcomes at the end of the day. And some physicists will claim that's all you need, and I think that I disagree with that. I think that you need much more than that.
I'm speaking with Sean Carroll about his latest book, Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Physicists speak of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. What's that?
That's what we teach our students. You know, that's the ideas that were put together in the late 1920s. Where you have different rules for quantum systems, how they evolve when you look at them and when you don't. It's what says that the idea of measuring the quantum system is fundamental. It's a crucial part of what you mean by quantum mechanics. And the rules say that when you measure a quantum system, it collapses. It was all spread out, and you know you didn't know where it was because there wasn't any such thing as where it was. But then you see it somewhere, so the state of the quantum system changes suddenly and dramatically. And all you can predict is the probability that you're going to get certain different measurement outcomes. What it doesn't tell us is what exactly a measurement is or what exactly is truly going on when you make that measurement. That's why it's a bit unsatisfying.
Didn't the physicists Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg develop the Copenhagen interpretation because they thought that something needed interpreting?
Yeah, you know, this is, again, an attitude that some people had. We have these ad hoc rules in quantum mechanics. They work really well. You can do chemistry, you can do physics with them. But there's some terms in the rules that don't seem to be perfectly well-defined. So some people say, like, I want more explanation here about what's going on. And that's what is meant by an interpretation of quantum mechanics.
There are several
terms. I don't like...
Go ahead.
Sorry?
No, continue what you're saying.
I don't really like the word interpretation in this context, to be honest. You know, those were the bad old days in the 20s and 30s where that was what we thought we needed. I think it's much more clear now that we have specific, well-defined physics theories that say absolutely definite things that are different from each other, but that all look like quantum mechanics at the end of the day. And so what the current debate is about is not about this or that interpretation. It's really about different theories of physics.
There are several terms that leave non-physicists scratching their heads, like wave function collapse, entanglement, non-locality, decoherence. I don't know if I should ask you to explain any of them, but are they particularly important in grasping the puzzles of quantum mechanics?
You know, they are, and I can recommend that the audience read my new book where I talk about these things in great length. But it's interesting that it took a long time for physicists to really appreciate the importance of these ideas. And it's really all these words that you're mentioning come down to a single idea, which is that in classical mechanics, if you talk about two different particles, there's what one particle is doing and what the other particle is doing. And you can talk about them completely independently from each other. But in quantum mechanics, they can be entangled. So it's not that there's a separate wave function, which is the term we use for the quantum mechanical state, a separate wave function for one particle and a different wave function for the other. There's just one wave function for all the particles in the universe at once. So even if you can't say with absolute confidence what experimental outcome you will get when you measure one particle, you might be able to say that when you measure one particle, you now are completely certain what measurement you'll get for the other particle. That's what entanglement is all about. And that's much more central to sort of the inner nature of quantum mechanics than anything that was being talked about in the 1920s. It really wasn't until the 30s where Einstein and Schrödinger really emphasized the importance of entanglement.
I admit that I have a hard time grasping the concept of superposition, in which particles seem to be in two or more places or states at the same time.
Yeah, well, you should, because we don't really...
Has anybody explained like that? I don't even know how somebody could even come up with the idea. Is it just based on mathematics?
No, I mean, it took years. You know, this is why relativity was much easier to invent than quantum mechanics was. And relativity was basically one guy, Einstein, to some approximation, coming up with the important ideas, whereas quantum mechanics took decades, many brilliant people banging their heads against it. And it was a slow back and forth. You know, we were arguing for a long time, is light particles or waves? And eventually people seemed to say, okay, it's definitely a wave. You know, in the 1800s, Maxwell and others showed that light is electromagnetic waves. But then in the 1900s, Planck and Einstein started to say, but you know, light also has particle-like properties. So it took a few years, but people started to say, well, okay, maybe what we think of as particles also have wave-like properties. And that's where the idea of superposition came from. It's very tempting to say an electron, you know, is in many places at once. But I think if you're really being super accurate about it, it's not anywhere. The state of the electron is not described by its location in space. It's described by a wave. Like when you see a wave on the ocean, you say, where is it? You can kind of approximately point to where it is, but there's no individual point in space where that wave is located. It's a feature of the ocean itself, and that's how we now talk about electrons.
Now, you mentioned that many different people have developed the theories of quantum mechanics. They come from different countries, different cultures, in some cases even places that have different approaches to mathematics. Has that made the whole thing a bit more complicated?
I don't think so. I mean, in some vague way, it did. I think one of the reasons why this quest to dig deeply into the meaning of quantum mechanics and really try to understand it suffered a blow when the central activity in physics shifted from Europe to the United States. Europeans tended to be more trained in humanistic philosophical traditions. Bohr and Einstein and people like that really had a wide-ranging grasp on a lot of different ideas, and they kind of did want to dig into the central notions, whereas Americans, bless their hearts, they're more pragmatic, right? They're like, what can I do with this? What can I build? It was the time when World War II was ramping up, and we were thinking about nuclear physics and the atomic bomb, and people just became very focused on applications rather than the underlying principles. So in that sense, there might have been some effect, but, you know, ultimately, the physical world is the same, no matter where you grow up, no matter what math you use. And so that made lots of people be able to make contributions to the same theory.
The popular view is that science tells us the way the world really is. Do physicists disagree about what quantum mechanics tells us about the world?
Absolutely. And, you know, some physicists say that we shouldn't even care whether quantum mechanics tells us anything about the world, as long as we can make the predictions for observations.
As long as it works.
So that's, yeah, exactly. And but I think that's wrong, and I think that, you know, it's shifting. The view within the physics community is changing a little bit. But absolutely, this insistence that I really want to know what's happening has been missing in our discussion of quantum mechanics for several decades now. And I think that we should step up and try to do a little bit better.
If physicists don't understand quantum theory in some essential ways, what kind of consensus can there be on how to proceed in research?
Well, there's different ways. You know, the most typical way is to ignore the problem, right? To just use those rules that were handed down to us. Like I said, we can build transistors and lasers and atoms and do interesting experiments and a whole bunch of things you can do without knowing the basic features of quantum. And therefore, I think it's easy to trick yourself into thinking that there's nothing that really requires a true understanding of quantum mechanics. But I think that's the mistake, and I think that that's where people are getting stuck with things like gravity. You know, we don't have a good quantum mechanical understanding of gravity or of space-time, of Einstein's general relativity. And to me, if we admit we don't understand quantum mechanics, then why in the world should we hope to understand quantum gravity? You know, we should obviously try our best to understand the fundamental framework before we get too worked up about any individual application within that framework.
Almost a century ago, in the mid-1920s, didn't Bohr and Einstein debate issues of the quantum theory? Was there a specific problem that they were trying to resolve?
They did. There's the very famous Bohr-Einstein debates that started in the 1920s and went into the 1930s. And, you know, some of them were literally, you know, at the same conference. They would talk to each other back and forth. But other of these debates were either letters back and forth or publications in journals. And roughly speaking, you know, Bohr was defending the establishment conventional view with the Copenhagen interpretation. We had a way of understanding quantum mechanics that was good enough. Let's get to work and put it to use actually building things. Whereas Einstein was saying, no, we really need to probe into the central mysteries here. And he kept trying to bring up mysteries, and Bohr kept trying to shoot them down. And some of Einstein's attempts stuck, and we're, you know, still thinking about these mysteries. And others, Bohr answered very, very effectively.
I've often heard that Einstein said, God does not play dice. I don't know if he actually said it, but if he did, what would he have had in mind in this context?
Well, he did say basically that. And, you know, I think that he kind of later regretted it because, you know, God does what God wants to do in some sense. You know, we have to figure out what God is doing, not tell him what's okay and what's not. But what he was getting at was this idea that according to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, the best you could ever do to predict the outcome of an experiment is to say the probability of seeing one answer or another. There is no fact of the matter ahead of time that you could possibly ever discern about what the answer was going to be. So basically, Einstein was saying in the Copenhagen view of quantum mechanics, every time you measure a quantum system, God rolls some dice, and there's a probabilistic outcome that is then revealed to us. And he thought that that was just not in accordance with his deep-seated feelings about how nature probably works. And it's important to have deep-seated feelings about how nature works, but they can also get in your way if you cling to them too stubbornly.
Hadn't Einstein's own research played a critical role in leading to the formulation of quantum mechanics? What had led him and others to question classical physics?
Well, Einstein took, maybe the first truly big step toward quantum mechanics. It was actually Max Planck in 1900 who did this formula, wrote down a formula for black body radiation. So if, you take a material, take a stainless steel pan and put it in your oven and heat it up to some high temperature, the whole pan is going to start to glow because it gets so hot, right? And that's, you can do physics on that. You can measure the different wavelengths of light coming out, and you can figure out the spectrum, as we call it, how much red light, how much blue light, how much infrared. And you can make a prediction for how much should come out, and the predictions in the 1800s were wildly inaccurate. They were totally wrong. So Max Planck said, well, maybe when the material is radiating, giving off radiation, it only emits it in discrete chunks of energy. This is the first tentative move towards quantizing light. And Einstein came along 5 years later and said, it's more than that. It's not just it is emitted in discrete packets of energy, but light only ever exists in discrete packets of energy. It's really particles, which we now call photons. And that was, the first big step toward quantum mechanics.
And so did Einstein, do you think, just feel, I've pretty much led the way, and now these people are coming up with these cockamamie theories that claim to arise out of what I've done, but things that I don't really understand, what he calls spooky?
Yeah, I think it's very important to emphasize there was never a point at which Einstein did not understand what was going on. He knew everything that everyone else knew about quantum mechanics. He was a very smart cookie, that Einstein. He could keep up just fine. But he had high standards. He didn't think that the state of the art in what was being done in quantum mechanics was up to snuff in terms of what you should ask of a good theoretical physics formulation of the fundamental laws of reality. So it wasn't that he didn't understand it. He thought we should do better. He thought that quantum mechanics was great. It was wonderful. It was deep. It was profound. It was true. But he thought it wasn't done yet. He thought it was a step along the way, and we should try to find a more complete description of nature.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
A quark is a fundamental constituent of matter. Observed in 1968 through deep elastic scatter, we found that protons aren't as simple as we thought. We thought they were solid particles, but they are not. Protons, in fact, are made up of three separate pieces. It just gets more confusing as our knowledge increases. But that is what a quark is. It's a piece of a proton. And they also make up other things, including a neutron. Oh, up, down, strange charm, top, bottom. If you don't know what a quark is, it don't matter. You still got them. And with leptons and bosons, unless something's amiss, they make up everything that we can see and that we know exists. Things made up of quarks, including protons and neutrons, are composite particles.
We are back with Sean Carroll, the theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology and host of the Mindscape podcast, author of any number of books. And the latest one, the one that we are discussing, is called Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time, and it is published by Dutton. And you mentioned philosophy, and parts of your book touch on philosophy. You quote Ludwig Wittgenstein, Elizabeth Anscombe, David Albert, among others. Haven't some physicists like Richard Feynman found philosophy even laughable, kind of contemptible?
They have, and they also admit that they don't understand quantum mechanics. So maybe they should listen to philosophers a little bit more.
So philosophy and quantum mechanics have some kind of connection?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the philosophers historically have been much more responsible about taking seriously the demands of quantum mechanics and trying to understand it when the physicists sort of abandoned that project. And, philosophers' job is not to come up with the right theory of quantum mechanics or anything else. philosophers do conceptual analysis and try to figure out where the mistakes are and what things fit together and what things don't and what things might make sense and what things can't. And they've done a very good job of that with quantum mechanics. And physicists have dropped the ball. Physicists have not actually done their part in developing theories and making experimental predictions and testing those predictions, which is what we're supposed to be good at.
The producer for this segment studied physics and says that one of his professors, who was a former grad student under Kip Thorne at Caltech, responded to a question by saying, "But that's just philosophy."
Yeah, you know, look, physicists are no different than anyone else in academia. Everyone in academia tends to be a little insular. Everyone thinks their discipline, their department is the best, and the rest are, you know, kind of pretenders that we put up with a little bit, right? But I think that this kind of issue, the fundamental nature of reality, sits squarely at the overlap of physics and philosophy. It's not the only one. There's other issues like the origin of the universe that also have that character. So I think that, you know, it's time to put aside the petty squabbling between different academic disciplines and take the problems of reality seriously.
How much work is being done currently in the field of quantum physics, especially compared with other areas of physics?
Well, there's an enormous amount of work being done in quantum physics. You know, building quantum computers, as we started talking about, is absolutely quantum physics. But the what we call the foundations of quantum mechanics, trying to understand the measurement problem, trying to understand the best way to describe reality, trying to understand the origin of probability and things like that, that is a very, very minority pursuit. You know, there might be hundreds of people doing that rather than tens of thousands of people looking at particle physics or astrophysics.
So we have the applications of quantum physics being applied, but is that surprising given the disagreements over interpretations of the theory, or is it just a matter of if the theory works, it doesn't really matter how it's interpreted?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting situation, but, you know, in retrospect, it makes sense where we can use a theory very well without understanding it. You know, we use technology every day without understanding what's going on inside, and this is something that we're able to do with quantum mechanics. Now, there is a limit to that. Like, the more you press at the boundaries of your understanding, the more it's going to be important to know what's really going on. So I think that one of the reasons why the urge to understand quantum mechanics is a little bit more obvious among physicists today is precisely because of technological advancements like quantum computing and quantum information that bring us to the boundaries of the rickety, old-fashioned Copenhagen way of thinking about these problems.
Hasn't there been recent progress in relating space-time to quantum entanglement? What is that doing? Is it opening new paths to the understanding of quantum gravity?
I think so, personally, yeah. You know, I think that, like I said, gravity and quantum mechanics don't play well together. This is a long-standing problem that physicists have been struggling with. And in my mind, a lot of the problem comes from the fact that even when you're a highly trained quantum physicist, you normally build a quantum mechanical theory by starting with a classical theory, and then there's a procedure called quantizing the classical theory. But nature doesn't do that. The world doesn't start with a classical theory and then quantize it. Nature is just quantum from the very start. So when it comes to gravity, we're in this situation where we have a very good classical theory, general relativity. We try to quantize it, and it blows up in our face. Mm-hmm. You know, the experiment does not work. So people are beginning to try to think more intrinsically quantum from the get-go. And one of the biggest tools we have in our toolkit is entanglement, the fact that different parts of the quantum mechanical wave function can be related to each other in an intimate way. And maybe, the idea goes, these different parts of the wave function can string together to build up space-time itself. That's a very different view on gravity and the emergence of space-time, which I think is absolutely related to thinking about how quantum mechanics works in the first place.
In discussions I've had with physicists about string theory, they have talked about the fact that a theory has to have a certain elegance to it. It can't be messy. But aren't many of the things we're discussing here kind of messy?
Yeah, of course. But you start messy, and hopefully you discover the hidden beauty inside, you know. One of the single, arguably the most beautiful theory in all of physics is Einstein's general relativity. his theory of space-time. You know, once you understand it, it's just so beautiful and compelling. You're like, how could it be any other way? But on the road to it, it took him 10 years to go from special relativity to general relativity, and man, it looked ugly along the way. There are some ugly equations. He made mistakes, and, you know, it's not at all clear. That's why it's work. That's why, you know, it's not obvious what the right answer is. You have to sort of make some approximations, cut some corners, see what looks promising, and go from there.
You focus in your book on what's called the many worlds formulation that was developed by Hugh Everett in 1957. Can you give us an introduction to Everett's theory?
Yeah, Everett basically said that all these weird rules that are in the Copenhagen interpretation about when you observe a quantum system that changes dramatically right away, he said, forget about those weird rules. Throw them away. Just ignore them. Instead, recognize that you, the observer, are a quantum system yourself. And when you observe something, it's not that there's some magical collapse of the wave function and suddenly there's a result. It's that you have a wave function, and your wave function becomes entangled with that of what you're looking at.
I have a wave function?
You do, yeah. You're part of the wave function of the universe, to be more precise, yes. Mm. So you're a quantum system. You're a little bit of a wave. Your wave is very, very highly localized where you're sitting there, so don't worry about it. You don't need to know this. But until you measure a quantum system, and then if you're measuring an electron, for example, spinning clockwise or spinning counterclockwise, what Everett says is that when you measure it, you transfer, evolve into a superposition of the electron was spinning clockwise and you saw it spinning clockwise, plus the electron was spinning counterclockwise and you saw it spinning counterclockwise. And then he says, both of those are real. They're just separate universes now. They've split off from each other. They've branched apart. And there's two different copies of the world. That's his theory.
Well, the use of the word wave gets confusing to me because right now we are broadcasting over the airwaves.
That's right. You know, we use the language, English language, that was invented long before quantum mechanics was. So we're stuck with some words here that don't quite map onto the full richness of reality. So we use waves in a way, you know, for ocean waves, for electromagnetic waves, for fairly down-to-earth purposes. And we also use the idea of a wave function for electrons or for the universe when we talk about quantum mechanics. These things are related, but they are different. So, you know, if it doesn't sound completely sensible, that's not completely your fault.
And you refer to, I'm quoting, the existential horror of multiple copies of the macroscopic world being described in a single wave function. Multiple copies of the macroscopic world?
Yeah, so when you measure that electron and you get a different answer, according to the many worlds theory, there are now two copies of the entire universe. One copy in which you saw the electron spinning clockwise and the other copy of which you saw it spinning counterclockwise. And there are many, many, many times, like a huge number of times, where the universe just branches into multiple copies like this. And so there are many, many copies of you in different versions of reality. This is the explicit, unambiguous prediction of quantum mechanics.
Einstein died in 1955, two years before Everett came up with the many worlds theory. You can only wonder what he might have made of this formulation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he would have had mixed feelings, to be honest. I think his first reaction would have been horror. The idea that there are, you know, multiple copies, it seems very far away from Einstein's attempt to find something that is sort of compact and pristine as a way of describing reality. But on the other hand, he definitely would have appreciated the fact that it's at least a well-defined theory. There's no magic, there's nothing spooky, there's nothing unexplained or ill-defined or anything like that. So it's a realist theory. There's nothing about our knowledge. Human beings are not special. So he would have absolutely appreciated its benefits.
Is physics any stranger than explaining things occur because of invisible forces in the forms of gods or spirits of some kind?
I don't know if it's stranger, but it's certainly way better because we have equations. We have absolutely clear things that say what is going to happen unambiguously in every particular instance. So the thing about physics is it's definite. You know, it doesn't say there are tendencies or, you know, there's proclivities for certain things to act in certain ways, or there's natural ways that things happen. It says, you start here, this is what happens. And that rigidity, that unforgiving nature of physical predictions, makes it easy to sift through ones that don't work because there's a firing line. You know, you have to fit the data, otherwise we throw you away and look for something better.
Niels Bohr was still alive, and he met Hugh Everett. Do we know what he made of the many worlds theory and some of the other theories that came along after he came up with his original theory? Heisenberg,
yeah, Bohr,
adding things and others?
Right. I mean, he did not like many worlds at all, Niels Bohr. And there was another competitor that came along at about the same time called Bohmian mechanics, which is a version of what are known as hidden variable theories, where if you want to know why an electron sometimes looks like a wave and sometimes like a particle, David Bohm says it's because it's both. There is a wave there and there is a particle, and there's what it does versus what you see, which are different. And Bohr didn't like any of this because he thought he had solved all these problems in the 1920s with the Copenhagen interpretation. So if it's the 1950s and people are saying, well, we have a better idea, he was very resistant to that.
Has quantum theory made surprising predictions that have turned out to be the case?
Oh, yeah, over and over again. I mean, there's a cottage industry of writing popular articles about the shocking new experimental result from quantum mechanics, and where you dig into them, it's exactly what would have been predicted in the 1920s. You know, we're stretching our technological capabilities to test quantum mechanics in different ways, and that's leading to predictions that are surprising to us, but they were there in the predictions. They were always there in the quantum formalism all along.
Last year, scientists using an IBM quantum computer reported that they were able to reverse the aging of a simulated elementary particle by 1/1,000,000th of a second. Is that something that's predicted in quantum mechanics?
Yeah, absolutely. Like every experiment ever done is compatible with what has been predicted by quantum mechanics. Wow.
Is that all-encompassing?
Yeah, well, no, it's the other way around. Like if you had actually done an experiment that contradicted what is predicted by quantum mechanics, you would win multiple Nobel Prizes. You would be the most famous scientist of all time. Like, if you could show that quantum mechanics is not right somehow, that would win you fame and fortune. No one has been able to do that. There's not even any hint. There's not even any suggestion of a possibility right now in the data that quantum mechanics is somehow not up to the task.
Is time travel theoretically possible under current theories?
Well, we don't know. That's another area where current theories are just not good enough to give a definitive answer. The probable answer is no, time travel is not possible. You know, we can travel to the future. We all do it every day. We move 24 hours into the future. But zooming backward, looping back and traveling to the past seems to not be possible.
If the many worlds hypothesis is right, is communication between worlds possible?
For all intents and purposes, no. I mean, this is why they are different worlds. Once the worlds branch, once they split apart from each other, there's no way to peek in on what's going on in the other one. So, you know, you can hook things up so you make a different decision in one world rather than another if you promise to obey the decision of some quantum mechanical measurement outcome. But you can never find out what life would have been like if you had done things the other way. So they truly are separate worlds. They're not around the corner to be conversed with.
You dedicate your book to, quote, the thinkers throughout history who stuck to their guns for the right reasons. Did you have any specific people in mind when you wrote that?
Well, people like Hugh Everett. You know, people, all the people throughout the 20th and 21st century who have insisted that we should try to understand quantum mechanics better. People like Einstein and Schrödinger, for example. You know, there's, and I said for the right reasons, for a very definite reason. You know, when there is an establishment, when there is a conventional wisdom, when there is a certain received way of thinking about things, even if it's wrong, there's still a whole bunch of non-conventional ideas that are even more wrong, right? It's easy to say, well, you know, the establishment is bad because it doesn't accept my crazy idea, but maybe that's just because your idea is crazy. So just because people don't agree with you doesn't mean you're right.
Both Einstein's equation for general relativity and Schrödinger's in quantum mechanics look opaque, but also small and simple. Have things remained simple or elegant or concise in quantum or in gravitational theory?
They have, and that's a great question, because as soon as someone in physics comes up with a successful theory, other physicists are going to try to mess with it, right? So we've absolutely tried to modify Einstein's equation. So far, no go. So far, no experiment has shown any indication that's on the right track. And on the theoretical side, when you try to muck with Einstein's equations, things tend to go wrong. You know, things tend to give you nonsensical answers. We're not sure about that. There's some examples that might work, but it's hard to imagine doing that. And it's even harder with the Schrodinger equation of quantum mechanics. I mean, you're right. These are two wonderful examples of things that look completely impenetrable to non-experts mm-hmm. who don't know the notation. And they're two of the most fundamental equations of reality that we have. And we would love to figure out a way to make them better one way or the other. But so far, they're hanging in there.
Is it important for to the general public to understand all of these things? How well is quantum physics being taught, especially, first of all, in our schools?
I think it's important that we give the general public the opportunity to understand these things. Look, if someone doesn't care that much about quantum mechanics, that's okay. I'm not going to give them a hard time about that.
You still can live your life and have
live your life, right? You go through your life. But I think that there are a lot of people who would like to understand it better if they could. And so I think that, you know, it's incumbent on us who are supposed to be professionals in the field to make it as accessible as we possibly can and then let people decide whether they want to understand it better or not.
Could a better groundwork be laid earlier in high school science classes?
I think so.
Are students in other countries exposed to quantum theory in high school?
I'm really not familiar. I really don't know. But I do think that we have this feeling that I disagree with, that we should teach the same physics to physicists as to everybody else, but just give everyone else a watered-down version, which means that when we teach high school physics, we teach people inclined planes and pendulums and all the stuff that a first-year physics major needs to learn in a university, but then the physics majors go on to learn the fun stuff, right? Quantum mechanics and cosmology and atomic physics and whatever. And we never teach the fun stuff to high school students. And I think that, you know, that's a little bit backwards. We should be teaching people about the Big Bang and black holes right away. Why not tell them some of that interesting part of physics?
I have to admit that I was not the best student of physics in high school. And my physics teacher, Mr. Johnson, said that he was passing me, giving me a passing grade only because he didn't want to have to see me for another year.
That works.
There are some people who are great at math. There's some people who aren't. But are there problems with the way physics or the natural sciences are being taught?
Yeah, you know, I have my disagreements, but I don't claim to be a super expert. You know, I haven't spent a lot of recent time in high schools seeing what goes on. There's two things that seem pretty obvious to me. One is that I would like to give people more of the fun stuff, whether it's physics or whether it's chemistry or biology. You know, I think there's so much cutting-edge stuff going on right now. Most high school students are not going to become professional scientists, so we shouldn't think of our job in high school science as giving them step one of a 10-step program. We should think that this is the last science course they might ever take. Let's tell them some of the best stuff we have. And the other thing is, you know, I think a lot of science education teaches scientific facts, right? This is how the world works. Learn it and be able to reproduce it on your test. Whereas the spirit of science is much more about the method and the procedure. It's not about the facts. It's about making hypotheses and testing them. It's really about that methodology. And I don't think we do a good enough job of getting that across to our students.
Hasn't there been a growing hostility to the sciences and to universities in this country, especially under the current political climate, most notably in some of the more conservative parts of the country?
You know, it's always hard to tell because it's always hard to get an objective measure of these things. I think that, you know, around the country, if you just ask people, do you respect science? Is science good? You will get overwhelmingly positive answers. But there is absolutely a tendency in some circles to be able to deny scientific results that they don't want, whether it's about evolution or global warming or what have you. And I do think that that tendency seems to be more prevalent now. You know, again, it's hard to be objective about that, and I would love to see data about it. But the tribalism, the motivated reasoning, the ability of people to believe things because they want to believe them rather than because it's what the evidence points to, does seem to be happening, and it's a little bit worrisome.
I did a show with a climate scientist who talked about death threats that some of her colleagues had received and loss of funding in some cases, all because of the fact that there was this hostility to what the scientists were saying. I imagine that that's less likely when we're talking about quantum mechanics because I can't imagine that too many people in Washington even have a clue as to what quantum mechanics is all about.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I don't get death threats most of the time.
You know,
yeah, but people do have strong opinions about things, right? So people do, you know, have feelings about many worlds. You know, my book came out, and I get a lot of 5-star reviews on Amazon, and I get a lot of 1-star reviews because people are like, this is nonsense. How dare you think anything like this? So there's definitely people out there with strong feelings one way or the other.
Was it a problem in writing this book, the fact that on the one hand you want to make all of these things clear to somebody who is not all that sophisticated in science, and at the same time, you don't want to insult the people who know a lot about science?
Yeah, I don't think there's any problem with insulting people who don't know a lot about science. You know, I try in my books and in my talks and so forth to tell it straight, to tell people, you know, what's really happening. And so my books are a little more challenging. You know, I don't want to simply give people a warm and fuzzy feeling about how cool and weird stuff is. I really want them to understand what's going on at some level. It'll never be the level that you understand if you go to university and take a bunch of classes and learn the math and learn how to solve the problems. But I think you should be able to understand the underlying ideas. So that's what I aim to try to provide.
But although classical physics, like relativity, offers a clear and unambiguous relationship between what we see and what the theories describe, quantum mechanics turns that structure on its head and argues that what the world seems to be is fundamentally different than what it actually is.
Yeah, you know, that's what makes quantum mechanics unique, and it's sort of uniquely good and uniquely bad. It's bad because we haven't faced up to this issue that measurements and observations play such a central role, but that means that there's an opportunity there, you know. Science proceeds by not understanding things, by getting stuck and stepping back and thinking and saying, you know, how can we do better? What is it that we're doing wrong? What do we need to improve? And the fact that we don't understand something about quantum mechanics might be an opening, might give us an opportunity to really move forward in some interesting ways.
Your subtitle of your book is Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Can you explain space-time?
Space-time is where we live, right? If you want to meet somebody for coffee, you tell them where you want to meet them, but you also tell them when you want to meet them. Those are the pieces of information that locate you in the world. Of course, that was always true. That would have been true for Galileo.
But we didn't give it a name like space-time in the past. We just said to see it tomorrow.
Exactly. But, you know, we did give them separate names, space and time. It wasn't until relativity came along in the early 20th century that we realized that it's better to think of it as one four-dimensional space-time rather than separate space and time, because how we divide up space-time into space versus time will be different for different people.
I mentioned at the start of this interview that Kip Thorne, your colleague at Caltech, had helped to develop Interstellar, which dealt with relativity and gravitational theory. Do you think anybody can come up with a movie that would somehow apply quantum mechanics?
I don't doubt it. I'm very optimistic that can happen. And there could be some interesting things, but, you know, Hollywood does and should take license. The idea is not to present a documentary about the laws of physics, it's to tell a compelling story. So it's an interesting challenge always to tell as interesting a story as possible while remaining as close to the real world as possible.
Do you ever feel frustrated when a number of politicians, including our own governor here, Andrew Cuomo, make the point of saying that they're not scientists before they go on to advocate fence-sitting on issues?
Yeah, it's a little weird, you know, especially if you are a politician or a statesperson and your job is to make decisions about things, well, of course you're not a scientist, and you're also not a soldier or a spy or an economist, but you make decisions about these things all the time. I don't think that the procedures for making decisions are all that different. You talk to experts, you weigh the evidence, you use your critical faculties, and you go on from there.
Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at California Institute of Technology, and you have a podcast called Mindscape. Are you talking about these issues?
I have been, yeah. You know, I've talked to, you know, a couple of philosophers and a couple of physicists about deep issues with quantum mechanics. I've had a solo episode where I talked about the emergence of space-time. But the podcast is much broader than that. It's not mostly physics. I talk to neuroscientists. I talk to movie directors. I talk to musicians and historians. And we have a grand old time talking about ideas across the board.
And Sean Carroll's latest book is Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time, published by Dutton. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Hugh Sansom, who produced today's segment. If you're new to this program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter, and our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. The Tom Hartman program is coming up next, and we hope you'll tune in tomorrow when James Musich will discuss the 1,000 books to read before you die.